criminal that he's decided to skip the whole thing, and he's just showing up for the dinner afterwards. So there's going to be that sense of urgency expressed in the streets, and then I think people are going to take it one step further on Monday with Flood Wall Street. And also, as David said, you know, take it to the people who are really responsible for blocking progress and make those connections. You know, a lot of the people who are involved in organizing Flood Wall Street, I first met them in the context of Occupy Wall Street. And, you know, they understand that this is an economic system that is sacrificing people in the name of profit. They already knew that. What climate change tells us is this same logic of profit and growth above all else is sacrificing the very life systems that we all depend on, and that's an obvious connection to make, and it supercharges our movements with existential urgency. And you know, this isn't about a brand new movement; it's about all of our movements coming together.
Naomi Klein, I want to thank you for being with us. We're doing part two of this interview, and then we'll be broadcasting it on Democracy Now! Naomi's new book is out. This Changes Everything: Capitalism Versus the Climate. Democracy Now! Will be covering the climate march on Sunday from 10:30 to 1:30 Eastern Time. Go to democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Felser-Armato, Naomi Shaikh, Steve Martinez, Sana Kapani Masood, Rabbi Karen, Dina Gesder, Amy Littlefield. Special thanks to Julie Crosby, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Becca Staley. I'm Amy Goodman Gonzalez.
It's 5 o'clock p.m. You're listening to KBOO Portland, and the Thursday evening news is next.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Cascade Media Convergence, Friday, September 9th, space for media makers to network and share best practices, collectively learn skills, and lay the framework for continued collaboration and plant the seeds toward building a regional grassroots media coalition. There will be workshops, strategy sessions, and space and time for deeper discussions on all aspects of grassroots media. Again, that's the Cascade Media Convergence, September 19th through 21st at the University of Oregon Turnbull Center, 70 Northwest Cooch Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Robin Jackson Band music video release party, Friday, September 19th at 9 p.m. The Robin Jackson Band debut music video will be released, featuring members of March 4th, Vagabond Opera, and tons of Portland characters.
Also performing will be electro violinist and producer Mr. Moo and soul singer Lorena Massa.
Again, that's Robin Jackson Band Music Video Release Party, Friday, September 19th at the Secret Society Ballroom, 116 Northeast Russell in Portland.
More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Grendel's, a neighborhood coffee house offering organic coffee, sandwiches for breakfast and lunch, and Wi-Fi. Proud to support KBOO. Grendel's is open every day at East Burnside and 8th. Information at 503-595-9550 or facebook.com/Grendel's Coffee House. This program is also made possible in part by a grant from Northwest Connector, connecting riders to the Oregon coast through daily round-trip bus routes from Portland, Salem, and Corvallis. Northwest Connector buses are equipped with bike racks and offer 3-day and 7-day passes with transfers up and down the coast. Schedules and trip planner at nwconnector.net.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the United States Senate this afternoon approved a bill giving President Obama the authority to provide arms and training to moderate Syrian rebels.
President Obama has pledged 3,000 military and civilian personnel to help West African nations combat the worst Ebola breakout in history.
And we'll hear a special report from the Climate Train en route to People's Climate March in New York City.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, September 18th, 2014. I'm Ani.
And I'm Robert Barncord. A bill approving President Obama's plan to arm and train Syrian rebels has passed the Senate this afternoon, despite bipartisan opposition. The bill, which does not include any specific funding, allows the president to move forward with his recently declared plan to, quote, degrade and destroy ISIS forces by supporting moderate Syrian rebels. The president believes Free Syrian Army rebels to be an integral ally in an effective ground offensive against the self-proclaimed Islamic State. ISIS forces control roughly one-third of both Syria and Iraq and have provoked the president into calling for U.S. military intervention in the region, despite a weariness of war amongst United States citizens and congressional Democrats. In a bipartisan effort, the president reached out across the aisle to House Republicans in order to get the bill passed on Wednesday. Although the bill does not include the $500 million to equip the 5,000 Free Syrian Army rebels, it does authorize the Pentagon to arm and train these rebels in the use of larger weapons such as battlefield artillery, mortars, and anti-tank rockets. But the bill remains unspecific about the training plan's details, prompting lawmakers to voice concerns over whether the arms could end up in the wrong hands and possibly even be used against United States soldiers. The bill passed the Senate by a score of 73 votes to 22.
Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko spoke to a joint session of the U.S. Congress today to ask for so-called lethal aid from the U.S. in his government's ongoing conflict with pro-Russian separatists. The eastern regions of Ukraine have seen nearly 3,000 deaths from the conflict, and the cities of Luhansk and Donetsk have been under separatist control for months. Ukrainian forces were on the verge of recapturing the cities last month. However, both Ukraine and NATO allege that Russia supplied the rebels with enough weaponry to repulse the Ukrainian army. In his speech to Congress, Poroshenko made reference to the Russian aggression against Ukraine and made it clear that Ukraine fears Russia's ambition for control over former Soviet territories.
In February, when the world saw that no one could take away Ukraine's freedom, an external aggressor decided to take away part of Ukrainian territory. The annexation of Crimea became one of the most cynical acts of treachery in the modern history. Allow me remind you, 20 years ago, exactly 20 years, the Budapest Memorandum, Russia, along with the United States, United Kingdom, France, and China, vowed to provide for the inviolability of Ukraine's state border and territorial sovereignty. In reality, what we got from Russia was annexation and the war that has brought Ukraine to the brink of its survival. The Soviet Union had collapsed too quickly, creating the illusion that this chapter in history was closed and that this story had come to the end. But unfortunately, in might of the people, it has not ended. The imperialistic mindset is still there. Nostalgia for the Soviet Union and dismissal for the settlement that ended Cold War had been cultivating revisionist instinct. So what can bring the peace and what can maintain it? Common values, cooperation, interdependence, leadership and responsibility. This is the things who can defend the global security. So I urge you not to lend Ukraine, not to let Ukraine stand alone.
However, despite the warm reception Poroshenko received at the Capitol, President Obama refused his request for weapons. The administration provided a list of items costing a total of $46 million that the U.S. has already provided to Ukraine, in addition to $7 million of humanitarian aid to lend assistance to the battered civilian population. The non-lethal aid includes night vision goggles, blankets, radar, radios, helmets, and body armor. Poroshenko expressed his gratitude for the aid, but said, quote, "One cannot win a war with blankets."
In his speech to Congress, Mr. Poroshenko also made reference to Russian aggression towards other countries in regions that the Russian government refers to as the near abroad.
In year 2008, Russia troops occupied Abkhazia and South Ossetia. They now have invaded Ukraine. The right to protect ethnic Russians and even Russian speakers can and already has become a reason to fan the flames of war. Besides Ukraine, Russian speakers reside now in Moldova, Georgia, Kazakhstan, Baltic states, Poland, even in Germany, there's a very big majority. Bulgaria, Moldova, Georgia, Ukraine. Who is the next?
He went on to reference a recent incident in which the Russian security agency, the FSB, abducted an Estonian security official at the Russian border on charges of espionage. The official was delivering equipment to an undercover agent embedded within a Russian smuggling cartel, but was instead met by FSB agents, leading to the Estonian government believing that it had been a setup. Russian rhetoric toward the Baltic states of Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia has begun to take on a harsher tone as Russian President Vladimir Putin has decried what he sees as anti-Russian policies in those countries. All three countries have significant Russian populations. The Baltic governments are not expecting anything as drastic as the Russian annexation of Crimea, which happened earlier this year. Nevertheless, the increase in Russian belligerence has led NATO at their summit, held in Wales last month, to create a rapid reaction force to deploy to the Baltic states in the event of a military threat.
A California man has been arrested on arson charges in connection to the El Dorado County King wildfire that has raged out of control since Saturday. 37-year-old Wayne Allen Huntsman was arrested Thursday following an investigation begun by county officials immediately following the wildfire's weekend onset. Huntsman is being held at a $10 million bail, despite no prior arson-related arrests. Due to strong winds, soaring temperatures, and extremely dry conditions, thanks to a prolonged three-year drought, the state of California is experiencing the worst wildfire season ever. State Governor Jerry Brown declared a state of emergency on Wednesday in response to the conditions and has put all state resources at the disposal of his Office of Emergency Services in an effort to do everything necessary to contain and control the 11 major wildfires raging in California. A force of 3,300 firefighters has successfully dug containment ditches around 5% of the King Fire. Another Northern California fire has been effectively halted Tuesday after burning 150 buildings in the town of Weed, near the border of Oregon, and nearly 30 homes and two dozen other structures were consumed by a third wildfire in communities south of Yosemite National Park.
September is Hunger Action Month, and while food insecurity among seniors has already been a concern in Oregon, it's especially an issue for people over the age of 50, according to AARP of Oregon. KBOO's Wendell Davis has more on this in collaboration with the Oregon News Service.
Thousands of people in Oregon over the age of 65 who qualify for the SNAP or food stamp program don't sign up. That's the finding of a report from Partners for a Hunger-Free Oregon. It says in all but five Oregon counties, fewer than half of the eligible seniors receive federal food assistance. But the same could be said of another group, people in their 50s. Vandana Shrestha with AARP Oregon says they're approaching senior status and have many of the same expenses and employment challenges, but none of the benefits.
You don't have Social Security, you don't have Medicare, you don't have Older Americans Act supports. So you really are in a big gap period in life where there's very little support services available to address some of the key basic needs that you may be facing.
It's Hunger Action Month, and Shrestha says AARP Oregon volunteers are combing the state asking people over 50 to share stories about their experiences with hunger. She also hopes the month prompts employers to take a closer look at their hiring practices and to be more welcoming to older workers. Katie Furia handles SNAP outreach for Partners for a Hunger-Free Oregon. She says in some cases, people in their 50s and 60s who have never needed food assistance don't realize they're eligible or don't know how or where to apply. But many times, they pass it up for another reason.
Oftentimes we've heard that they don't want to take benefits away from others who need them more, while the SNAP program is actually designed to expand and contract with need so that anyone who is eligible would be able to receive benefits.
An AARP report on barriers to food stamp access for people in their 50s also found they assume the benefits they'd receive are so small that it isn't worth applying. In this age group, AARP says the number of people considered food insecure increased by 38% in the first few years of the recession. For the KBOO Evening News, in collaboration with the Oregon News Service, this is Wendell Davis.
An article in the Portland Tribune this week highlighted the permitting problems facing backyard beekeepers in Portland. Portland's beekeeping community has grown significantly in recent years. At the same time, honeybee colonies have been ravaged by colony collapses caused by diseases and pesticides in a mass death that has been widely recognized as an ecological crisis. Colony collapse is a significant economic problem as well, as bees are the primary pollinators of numerous staple crops across the globe and in Oregon. For more on the regulatory situation for Portland beekeepers, KBOO's Sam Bowman spoke with Tim Wessels of Urban Beekeepers.
Can you give me a little overview of what the permitting problems are that you and other beekeepers have been having?
Okay, well, initially what has happened is that I think the first part of the discussion came because there was there's a code written by the city of Portland that is enforced by Multnomah County and Vector Control Department. And so they, one of the pieces of that enforcement was there was a requirement for a signature of all the neighbors within 150 feet of your property line. So that was a pretty onerous process because in many cases that's meant, you know, quite a few houses, quite a few households, and it could be other businesses. And what we thought is that it could have set up the potential for discriminatory treatment by the beekeepers. You know, if they had a neighbor that didn't like their lifestyle or didn't care for their skin color or just didn't like them as in general, then they could basically stop them from obtaining a permit by not signing the release.
And that has happened, hasn't it?
Yeah, in a couple of cases it has happened. Yes, that's true. Several cases.
Is the city given any justification for this that kind of draconian requirements? Is there a safety concern or anything like that?
Well, and just so we're clear, it's not the city. The city has written the code. It's how it's interpreted by the enforcement agency, which is the Vector Control.
I see.
Folks over at Multnomah County. Now, and I have to say that we had a meeting on Tuesday that piece of the enforcement anyway has been modified or amended so that now it's just an affidavit. A mailing of an affidavit to notify your neighbors, and their signature portion of it has been removed, which we're very pleased with.
Out of, say, 200 beekeepers in Portland, only about 10% have permits?
Yeah, and, you know, that's just a ballpark because we don't know for sure, and we don't know all the beekeepers. But we do believe that a very small portion of them, because it's complaint-driven, There's no real incentive for them to obtain a permit. And in fact, there's as I mentioned, there's a disincentive in many cases because of there's the potential of them not being able to get one, and then at which time they would not be allowed to have bees because then they'd be on the radar for having hives in their backyard, and they'd probably in the past would have had to have those removed.
Has the beekeeping community in Portland been growing pretty significantly in recent years?
It really has. I mean, as an association, we started three years or so ago. It's like maybe a half a dozen of us or so meeting in a pub and talking about bees and beekeeping. And we've grown now to over 175 members, I believe, and we have over 1,000 members on our online discussion page on Facebook. And there's a lot of interest. It's sort of a Portland thing, where I think somebody said that the bees are the new backyard chickens, but I think that's, relatively simple. I think really what it comes down to is Portlanders tend to look at anything that they can do and make a significant impact in what it is they're doing, whatever it is, whether it's art or music or the keeping of certain animals or pets or whatever. And so you see that, and the one thing I hear, the most common comment that I hear is, boy, the bees are in trouble. I'd like to be involved with this and see if there's anything I can do. Now, just the keeping of bees themselves is not necessarily going to benefit honeybees. It's nice, and I think the side benefit is what's significant is those people that have bees in their backyard, they reach out to their neighbors and to their friends and family, and then they tell them about all the things that are harmful to honeybees and other pollinators, and they explain to them all the beneficial things that they can be doing, like removing lawns and parking strips and planting, a variety of pollinating flowers for them. So the net benefit is huge for having local people be involved with bees, because they themselves learn so much about the bees, but then they wind up becoming educators and teachers for not just honeybees but all the pollinators.
Great. Tim Wessels, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Sure, absolutely. Thank you.
For KBOO Evening News, this is Sam Bowman speaking with Tim Wessels of Portland Urban Beekeepers.
Voters in Scotland today cast their ballots in a referendum on whether or not the country should become independent of the United Kingdom. The polls closed at 10 p.m. or 2 p.m. our time, and the totals will be counted overnight with a final announcement of results in the early morning. 97% of eligible voters have registered to cast a ballot in the referendum, and opinion polls have so far shown the yes and no sides to be neck and neck. The lead-up to the referendum has seen intense argument over the issue, accusations of bias at the British Broadcasting Corporation against Scottish independence, and lots of money being pumped into both campaigns. The referendum is advisory, and a yes vote would set off 18 months at least of negotiations between Scottish and English officials over the fate of their mutual interests and responsibilities. Scottish Independence Day would be set for March 24th, 2016. However, even a no vote would lead to changes in the relationship between Scotland and the UK, since UK leaders have offered to give Scotland more independence and control over its own affairs if the Scots vote no to secession. In addition, the referendum has galvanized Scottish grassroots politics, especially in poor urban areas, and firmly placed the idea of independence in the mainstream of political discussion.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for a special report from the Climate Train with KBOO reporter Yana Maximova, followed by Rose City Native Radio at 6 o'clock. At 7, it's Davey D's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather will be partly cloudy with a high of 79 and a low of 56, with no rain projected. Today in history, in 1889, Hull House was opened on Halsted Street in Chicago by Jane Addams and Ellen Gates Starr. It was one of the nation's first settlement houses, providing innovative social, artistic, and educational programs for residents of one of Chicago's poorest neighborhoods. The quote of the day is from Jane Addams: "Civilization is a method of living, an attitude of equal respect for all men."
It's 25 minutes after 5 and time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
One public service that people really like and count on is the post office, which literally delivers for us. Anti-government ideologues and privatization dogmatists, however, hate the very word public, and they've long sought to demonize the U.S. Postal Service, undercut its popular support, and finally dismantle it. Their main line of attack has been to depict it as a bloated, inefficient, outmoded agency that's a hopeless money loser, sucking billions from taxpayers. Never mind that USPS doesn't take a dime of tax money to fund its operations. It's actually a congressionally chartered for-profit corporation that earns its revenue by selling stamps and services to customers. And here's something that will come as a surprise to most people. The post office makes a profit, expected to be more than $1 billion this year. Yet, the media keep reporting that the USPS is losing billions of dollars each year. What they fail to mention, however, is that those are phony paper losses manufactured by Congress at the behest of corporate privatizers. Late in 2006, the lame duck Republican Congress rammed into law a cockamamie requirement that the Postal Service must pre-fund the retiree health benefits of everyone it employs or expects to employ for the next 75 years. Hello, that includes workers who are not even born yet. No other business in America is required to pre-fund such benefits for even 1 year. To add to Congress's cockamaminess, the service is being forced to put up all of that money within just 10 years, which has been costing USPS more than $5 billion a year. That artificial burden accounts for 100% of the so-called losses the media keep reporting. This is Jim Hightower saying, it's like tying an anvil around someone's neck, throwing the person out of a boat, and then saying, "Swim to shore, sucker."
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out at HightowerLowdown.org.
Rolling Jubilee is an offshoot organization of Occupy Wall Street. It's brought up about $3.85 million in student debt from Everest College for 3 cents on the dollar before canceling all of it on Wednesday. The action is the latest in a series of debt abolition efforts by the group, which has initially bought $15 million in medical debt spread across 2,000 patients for only $400,000 before canceling that debt. The group is taking advantage of a common debt economy practice where companies owed money, either in credit card, medical, or student debt, often sell that debt to other firms. But because that debt often does not get paid back, the firms purchasing it pay just pennies on the dollar, then go after the debtors for the original full amount. The Rolling Jubilee has been actively raising funds to cheaply purchase student and medical debt, then release the debtors from any further payment. The organization is part of a nationwide movement to combat crippling student and medical debt that they see as part of an unjust and costly system, preventing citizens from accessing health care and education. Although the lump sum of purchased debt may seem like a lot, the nearly $4 million in alleviated debt, when spread across 2,000 students, ultimately amounts to rather small chunks of any individual student's total amount. Rolling Jubilee realizes that their efforts, while appreciated, have minimal impact on the mountain of student debt in America, which now accounts for 10% of all debt, second only to mortgages. But they hope that their actions, which easily garner publicity, will highlight the debt crisis in America.
A new report dismisses claims by the National Security Agency that Edward Snowden's leaks have helped terrorists to avoid detection. The report by the private security firm Flashpoint contradicts assertions by United States officials that Edward Snowden's leaks about the NSA's surveillance techniques inspired Islamic terror groups to hide their electronic communications behind more sophisticated encryption software. The analysis examined the improvements made to the encryption software used by these groups and found no correlation with the Snowden leaks, which became public beginning back on June 5th of the year 2013.
President Barack Obama has finally responded to the worsening Ebola crisis in West Africa by pledging 3,000 U.S. military personnel, including doctors and engineers, who will establish 17 new treatment clinics, provide medical equipment, and actively train and recruit thousands of local healthcare providers. The U.S. aid comes at a time when the medical infrastructure of the nations of Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea is being overwhelmed by more than 5,000 cases, 2,600 of which have proven fatal so far. It's estimated that several more thousand cases exist and have gone unreported. President Obama previously received harsh criticism from aid workers, the World Health Organization, and Ebola experts for not responding swiftly when the crisis was in its infancy. But now the widespread extent of the outbreak seems impossible to ignore, and the president himself has stated that if the outbreak is not addressed and stopped, then hundreds of thousands of people may become infected with, quote, profound political, economic, and security implications for all of us, end quote. As the U.S. begins to act, several other nations have followed suit, with Britain, France, Cuba, and China all pledging infrastructural support and personnel. The World Health Organization has stressed the need for physical manpower, estimating that 500 to 600 additional foreign experts and 10,000 local health workers are needed to contain the epidemic. The region has experienced a string of health worker-related problems, including worker strikes, lack of pay, and doctors and aid workers becoming infected. The outbreak is the worst Ebola crisis since the virus was discovered in 1976 and has spread to 5 countries in West Africa.
Several South Vietnamese officials arrived in the U.S. today for a 3-day visit to try to promote the Trans-Pacific Partnership, known as TPP. The trade agreement would increase cooperation in economics, trade, and investment between the United States and Vietnam. The head of Vietnam's Ministry of Industry and Trade, along with the South Vietnamese Deputy Prime Minister, will be meeting with representatives from the United States Senate and House of Representatives, the U.S. Department of Commerce, the U.S. Department of the Treasury, and the Peterson Institute for International Economics. Kevin Zeese is an organizer at popularresistance.org. He spoke with David Swanson of Talk Nation Radio about how people are organizing across borders in opposition to the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
If we actually have the power to tell 80% of the country that the Trans-Pacific Partnership is in the works and what it is and why it should be opposed, we have a power I didn't know we had, because...
Well, that 80% is activists. I mean, those are speaking to activist audiences, and I think that's a very important, actually, point, because, you know, you have to look at information spreading and activism and mobilizing spreading almost like a archery target, you know, with concentric circles. And the initial circle is a small core group that, you know, gets a topic and starts to spread the word. It goes to the next circle, the next circle, the next circle. And now, I think it's now beyond the activist community that we have. And what's also interesting is when we start to do that, we start to get the message out about something like a TPP, for example. We'll just take that as an example. Then we force the core media to cover it. And so as we've seen the activist community get educated, organized, and mobilized around the TPP, it forces the corporate media to comment on it and report on it, because otherwise their credibility just shrinks even more. So they're in this very interesting position with shrinking credibility, and we're increasing our credibility and our readership and viewership. And so as we get things out, we actually can push the corporate media into covering something they hadn't covered. For example, we did this amazing action at the U.S. Trade Representative, which is where the negotiation of the TPP comes out of, or the White House. In fact, it's the building's right across the street from the old executive office building, the White House complex. We did an action. We covered their building in massive banners. Four massive banners, you know, 20 feet was the smallest one. And we did it at noontime, right across from the White House, with the intense security and able to pull it off. And it forced the Washington Post to cover it, saying it was the greatest guerrilla action ever. And it meant pictures of the banners were all in this big spread and inside the Washington Post as well as on their webpage. They even linked to a video that one of the activists working with us produced in their column. So we forced the media to cover it by just, you know, making it such a big noise that they had no choice or they'd lose credibility.
And yet there's still a section of the public to be reached, a few of whom may be listening to this program. Could you just give us the three or four worst bits of the Trans-Pacific Partnership for those who might not yet have heard and haven't made their way yet to popularresistance.org?
Well, it impacts negatively every aspect of our lives, from food and water to the internet access to finance, to power, the regulation of big banks. You pick an issue, labor, environment, they're all impacted negatively by this, and they make corporations more powerful than governments. We lose our local sovereignty to control local elections and local representatives to control how we protect our environment, protect our economy, and it's given over to this international corporate agreement. And it's being written by 600 corporate advisors, along with the U.S. Trade Representative, while it's kept secret from all of us and mostly secret from Congress. Congress members have to go through a bunch of hoops to see it and can't take notes, can't take pictures, can't bring their computer, can't bring staff, can't talk about it because it's classified as a secret. And so we're all kept in the dark while 600 corporate advisors work with Obama to write it. So it's a absolutely horrible agreement. The good news is we're stopping it. They've been trying for over 2 years now to get fast-track trade authority, which would essentially allow Obama to sign the agreement before Congress reviews it, and then Congress has a very short amount of time to vote up or down with no amendments. And they've been unable to get fast-track trade authority now for over 2 years. Without that, they can't pass it. And as we fight that successfully, it empowers countries around the world to say no to the president and the trade representative on their corporate agenda, because they're empowered if they see that we're being successful. So it's a synergy between countries around the world gaining power against the United States and the people of the United States gaining power as well. So we're winning, but the next battles are coming up in late November after the elections, or early November after the elections, and then next year we'll see what the legislative makeup is. We'll have another round of battles. But we're on the verge of winning this. We've been successful 2 years now. We can keep winning, and it'll be a tremendous victory of people versus transnational corporate power. So we hope we can, you know, keep the record up.
Kevin Zeese, thank you for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thanks for having me on. Good talking with you.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org.
Rob Merrifold, the Alberta tar sands new lobbyist in Washington, has said that the approval of the Keystone XL pipeline needs either three Democratic senators changing their votes or one, quote, Lac-Mégantic experience in America. The 2013 Lac-Mégantic disaster in Quebec occurred when an unattended 74-car train carrying crude oil derailed and exploded in a small town, resulting in the deaths of 47 people. Environmentalists argue that oil-by-rail accidents are not a good reason for building more pipelines to transport fossil fuels. Canadian scientist David Suzuki made the point earlier this year that increased movement of oil and gas by any method will result in more accidents. Suzuki and other environmentalists have called for a slowdown of the recent fossil fuels boom in Canada and the U.S. due to tar sands exploitation and fracking. Instead, they advocate greater investment in alternative energy development such as wind, solar, and geothermal power. The Keystone XL pipeline awaits the approval of the U.S. Senate, but approval is short by three Democratic votes that Merrifield referenced. Due to the contentious nature of the pipeline debate in the U.S., it's unlikely that any senator will make a controversial vote on the matter until after the November elections.
And now we'll hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. 14,500 airlines reservation agents in southern states have overwhelmingly voted to join the CWA-IBT Association. It's the largest organizing victory in the U.S. South in decades. The CWA's Kendra Chaikind.
Here we have 14,500 workers all across southern states who, you know, given the chance to have a voice in the job, voted yes. You know, here's what happens when you don't have an employer intimidating, threatening you, when you're not faced with huge anti-union campaigns, when you simply give people the choice between a union and not.
Three-fourths of the reservation agents work in Texas, North Carolina, Florida, and Arizona. 9,000 of them work for American Airlines, the others for U.S. Airways. The two airlines have merged. The U.S. Airways agents have been in the CWA since 2000, but for the other agents, it's been a long 19-year struggle to win union representation. The Chicago Teachers Union, AFSCME Council 31, and SEIU Healthcare of Illinois and Indiana are all calling on Chicago's mayor to file for arbitration to recover millions of dollars from toxic interest rate swap deals. The unions want Mayor Rahm Emanuel to end the deals they say are costing the city of Chicago and Chicago schools $100 million a year. The unions say banks like Bank of America and investment firms like Loop Capital are profiting from toxic interest rate swap deals at the expense of city services and education in Chicago. A similar effort is underway by a labor community coalition in Los Angeles. Similar deals have cost the public billions of dollars nationwide. Labor community coalitions say the banks did not properly disclose the risks involved in these deals when the economy was crashed in 2008 by big banks and their fraudulent and toxic complex financial instruments. The aftermath created historically low interest rates, and that, ironically, has meant the banks are profiting from the financial meltdown that they caused. A study released this week shows coal miners in Kentucky and other parts of Appalachia are getting serious cases of black lung disease at rates unseen since the 1970s. Researchers for the National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health found very high levels of progressive massive fibrosis. That lung disease was virtually eradicated some 15 years ago, but it's back with a vengeance now in Kentucky, Virginia, and West Virginia. Black lung is caused by inhaling coal dust.
Workers Independent News is brought to you by the American Federation of Teachers and its 1.6 million members working to reclaim the promise of public education, health care, and public services for our students, their families, and our communities. More information online at aft.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
And now the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.immc.org for Thursday, September 18th, 2014. Israeli troops kidnap civilians during invasions targeting West Bank communities and settlers attack Palestinian cars. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned.
Israeli soldiers invaded on Thursday at dawn in a Halim village to the west of Bethlehem, where they kidnapped four Palestinians, one in Mariha village, west of the northern West Bank city of Jenin, and another in Jerusalem. The army claimed that all kidnapped Palestinians are wanted for security violations. Furthermore, an Israeli military source in occupied Jerusalem said that soldiers kidnapped one Palestinian, allegedly, after he tried to attack soldiers with an axe. On Wednesday evening, soldiers invaded Ya'bud town to the south of Jenin and clashed with local youth. The army fired rounds of live ammunition, gas bombs, and concussion grenades. Several Palestinians suffered the effects of tear gas inhalation. In related news, a number of fanatic settlers from the Mebu Dutan illegal settlement threw stones and empty bottles at Palestinian cars driving at the main Jenin Tulkarim road. At the political level, Dr. Musa Abu Marzouk, a political leader of the Hamas movement, stated that indirect post-ceasefire talks between Israel and the resistance in Gaza would resume under Egyptian mediation in Cairo before September 24th. The Hamas official said that the United Nations, in coordination with Tel Aviv and the Palestinian Unity Government, would handle the reconstruction of Gaza and that there will be observers and a schedule for the entry of construction materials. Abu Marzouqa further said that Hamas movement has no objection or reservation on any mechanism set by the United Nations to ensure the entry of the urgently needed construction materials to the Gaza Strip. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Thursday, September 18th, 2014 News Roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Banoura.
In the latest news from U.S.-occupied Afghanistan, Sergeant Charles C. Strong, 28 years old, of Suffolk, Virginia, died September 15th during military operations in Herat province in Afghanistan. Major Michael J. Donahue, 41 years old, of Columbus, Ohio, and civilian Stephen Bias of Reynoldsburg, Ohio, both died on September 16th from wounds suffered during a Taliban attack in Kabul. 49 Taliban militants have been killed and 15 others arrested within the last 24 hours by combined Afghan security forces in 9 separate provinces. Operations also managed to confiscate a variety of light and heavy weapons.
Your participation. Call us with your breaking news
stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Ethan Martin and Wendell Davis. The producer is Sam Bowman. Special thanks to Yana Maximova. Our engineer is Pooh Epstein. The KABU Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/evening news, or look for us on Twitter at KABU News. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Ani.
And I'm Robert Barncourt. Coming up tomorrow morning on KABU at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Ani Haynes and Lynn Molek host Positively Revolting Talk Radio. The topic is Our State of Endless War. At 9, it's Veterans Voice with host Marvin Simmons. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11 on the Radio Zine, we speak with Barbara Quinn and Laura Feldman of Willamette Speaks about the Willamette Speaks storytelling event on Saturday, which seeks to gather community wisdom about the river and reconnect residents with the lower Willamette River by sharing stories. Thanks to all of you KABU members for your generous support. If you're not a current member, you can become one easily by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. Stay tuned now for KABU News In-Depth with a report from the climate train en route to this coming Sunday's public climate march in New York City.
Happy birthday, Will.
Hey, Will.
The United Nations Climate Summit will take place next week on September 23rd.
Secretary General Ban Ki-moon is urging world leaders to reach an agreement on how to combat the increasingly dire climate crisis. This coming Sunday, September 21st, people will be marching in New York City, the People's Climate March, to show solidarity for the struggle against climate change and call on world leaders to commit to a safe and healthy future for the planet and its inhabitants. The march is expected to draw about 250,000 people, making it the largest environmental march in U.S. history. Some marchers are making their way to New York City from distant western states on the climate train, piling on at Amtrak stations from Portland to Denver to Chicago to Santa Fe. KBOO reporter Yana Maximova is on the climate train and will be reporting from the People's Climate March and the Climate Summit. She attended a rally in Denver along the train's route.
Train, 120 of us boarded in Emeryville yesterday morning. We've been going strong since then. We've had sessions all day, so throughout the days, sharing skills and knowledge, building our connections with each other and the climate movement across state lines. When we left the Bay Area, we learned about the Bay Area refineries and the fossil fuel impacts there. We went through Utah. We had someone get on in Salt Lake City at 3 a.m. She shared with us about the potential threat of the first tar sands mine in the United States. We're seeing our entire country from coast to coast. We're learning about the concrete climate impacts, and we're headed to New York City to make our voices heard at the People's Climate March. When world leaders from around the globe are converging to talk about the climate crisis, but we know we need more than talk. We need action now. Penny Opal Plant with I Don't Know More.
All right.
I made this sign today on the train just as a reminder to us all that as the world are in there negotiating, supposedly, we hope, we pray that's what they're doing. We have to keep in mind that Mother Earth does not negotiate. There is no negotiating with her. We cannot ask her to not have an earthquake. We cannot ask her to not have a hurricane or a flood or a drought like the one that we're having in California, where water is being rationed. We cannot ask her to do those things. Because what she is doing is taking care of her biosystem, of her biosphere, of the way that it's supposed to be. And as indigenous people around the world, in the traditional communities, we still have those original instructions on how to live within her biosphere in balance and harmony. And some people might think that we are asking people to go backwards. But we are not asking anyone to go backwards. We're asking people to go forward with the right technology and the right way of thinking, that we are not separate from Mother Earth. We are not separate from the circle of life. We are as much a part of her as a lizard, as a hawk, as the hippopotamus. We are part of her. We are not separate. And the arrogance of humanity to think that we are separate from her, it will be our downfall unless we evolve beyond that way of thinking. And so join me in evolving. Thank you.
Also aboard the climate train was Dennis Moynihan, a Democracy Now! Correspondent who spoke with Yana Maximova about the importance of independent media in the climate movement.
As I look out here, we're crossing the Platte River. The sun is setting, and there is a train laden with coal that we're just going next to here because so much of our Front Range Colorado power comes from coal. It's not surprising that the media representatives on this climate train are grassroots media, KBOO radio, I'm fortunate to live in Denver, so Democracy Now! Was able to have someone here. But it's, you know, there's no corporate media here. They're funded largely by the companies that mine and ship this coal and other fossil fuels. So it's often said that there's no connection between the advertising and the content on a news outlet. I disagree. So listener sponsorship is kind of the cleanest, purest way to have a sustainable media operation of any kind. And if your listeners don't approve of what you're doing, they can withhold funding. Hopefully they won't. But it is an important, innovative way that media institutions like Cable and Democracy Now! Sustain themselves. And this is part of a movement to address climate change, but the forces allied against the movement are enormous. So hopefully what I've heard today on the train from the people I've spoken to is a sense of enthusiasm, celebrating the diversity of the people on the train. You know, everyone from impacted neighborhoods around the Chevron, the Richmond, California Chevron plant, to indigenous communities, and then the people from threatening near a potential tar sands mine in Utah. So a very interesting project, and I actually spend a lot of time in the high country right near the train tracks, so I'm familiar with the California Zephyr, the Amtrak train that we're on right now that goes between Chicago and San Francisco. So it's good to be on it and to see people using the trains to get around.
Right, the last one. What message does Danish Moynihan have for UN Climate Summit?
Wow. Well, for the UN Climate Summit, you know, it's important that the participants of the summit, the negotiators who represent largely, primarily nation states, listen to the people. I anticipate that the climate march that is happening this coming Sunday will be large. It's often too simple for decision makers behind closed doors to ignore the will of the people. And so it's going to be an important for them to recognize that there is a global movement growing. And of course, as the friends in the Pacific Northwest at the Earth First used to and still proclaim, nature bats last. So you can ignore the problem, but it's going to come back and bite you.
After passing through Chicago, Jana spoke with Finnish documentary filmmaker John Webster, who was making a film about the march.
Introducing yourself, talking about yourself.
Okay, my name is John Webster. I'm a documentary filmmaker from Finland. I'm riding the People's Climate Train as part of a documentary film I'm making on climate change. I've been making this film for about 4 years now, and finally we got to a period where we can start filming it. And this train and the march and the summit came at the perfect time for us, because the central theme of the film is what can one person do for people in the future. And so what people can do is join together and to have a louder voice.
Where did you start?
We started in Emeryville in San Francisco, near San Francisco.
Yeah.
And we're leaving the train here in Chicago.
Where would this film take you?
Where will it take us? Well, next stop is New York. We've been filming quite a lot in Switzerland. Maybe Holland. But I don't know. I think they're just places. I think, as an end documentary, it is the people that you meet along the way and what they have to say, which is the most important thing. And we've met some fantastic people on this train.
Can you speak about the climate change effect that you see in your home country in Finland?
Well, what I see is. That what the changes that I see are very close to what the scientific models say that they should be. So we have more extreme weather events. We have stronger rainfalls, more rapid rainfalls. We have changes in the autumn and spring. The spring comes about a couple of weeks earlier. Autumn comes a couple of weeks later. We're seeing animals and insects that we haven't seen before, ever. And those are right in line with what the models say. Or predict.
Can you speak about the media coverage of the climate change that you've seen in Finland, in Europe, and in the United States?
Yes. Well, I am so involved in climate change, and I feel very passionately about it because I definitely see it as it's the biggest threat that we have. So I'm sort of biased, and I think, well, in the sense that I think there's not enough. You know, in proportion to the threat, it's very little. If you look at, say, the coverage of Ebola, or the coverage of food poisoning incidents, the amount of people that can be affected is minimal compared to what climate change does. But that is part of the problem and the tragedy with climate change, is that it is so invisible to us. And it also is a threat that evolution has never prepared us for. It's something that happens gradually, slowly, in long time perspectives. We have emotional responses. Evolution has given us emotional responses so that we can react quickly to dangers. So, but there's evolution has never seen a reason why we should act quickly to something that will happen in 20 years. For us already, It's long enough to see over the next winter. We have enough food to survive over the next winter, or the birth of a child. So because there's no emotion, people don't feel emotional about it, it's not a good story. And because it's not a good story, it gets very little coverage. And so I'm trying to find a good story, a story that does raise awareness, does get people emotionally